Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the March 14th edition of National Review's Radio Free California Podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here when he's not there. He's an economist and author, the host of the Capital Record Podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Will, how are you doing, sir?
There is a world of activity that we could contemplate, but I want to start with March Madness.
Isn't that the world of activity you're talking about?
I was talking to Brian just a moment ago. He said, this is David's Super Bowl. And I said, isn't the Super Bowl David's Super Bowl? No. This is a whole different level of fanaticism.
Yeah, I do love March Madness. I always have. And, you know, there's a lot of great teams in there. This is a particularly fun year because there's, I'm not kidding, 16 teams that could win. 16 teams. 10 that I couldn't even separate their odds from one another.
Wow.
That's how much parity there is. And, you know, there's been a couple of teams that have really good years, Texas, Houston, Kansas. But, yeah, there's I mean, Duke is a number five seed in the tournament out of 64 teams, out of 16 brackets. So they're basically saying that they're somewhere around the 20th best team in the 64, anywhere between 16, 17, and 20. And Duke has won 9 in a row and has got, you know, they had some injuries earlier and they're on fire now. They just won the ACC tournament championship. So, I mean, it's wide open.
Talk to us about the Pac-12. SC, UCLA, both are in. UCLA's...
UCLA's definitely one of the 10 favorites to win the whole thing. I mean, they're very good. They had an injury. They ended up losing to Arizona in the Pac-12 championship, but they beat Arizona twice in the regular season. USC beat them once, lost another time, and USC also had a lot of injuries earlier in the season. Now they're at full strength now. But USC has to beat Michigan State in the first round. Mm-hmm. UCLA is, you know, like a 2 seed. I mean, the UCLA will certainly be in the Sweet 16 and has a very good chance of being in the Final Four.
Hmm.
I hate them. They're evil.
It must be said.
I wasn't just going to say something nice and leave it there.
You'll be, is there a trip in your future to go actually watch the launch of this?
I don't ever go to the actual games in the opening round because I do something so much better. Since 1997, I go out to Vegas for the opening round with a group of friends, some of which I only see at this tournament every year, most of which are like brothers to me, very, very close group. And we just watch basketball all day. I think most people know I don't drink. I'm not out there living it up. I'm just watching basketball, hanging with my friends, and eating really, really good food.
I was going to say, is it a free fire zone for you with regard to dietary restrictions?
There's no dietary restrictions.
None. Yeah, no. I can imagine.
No.
All right. Well, we have, as I say, so much to get to. Silicon Valley Bank, big housing lawsuit, lots of stuff to talk about. But let's start with just a couple of quick news items. Just yesterday, the California Appeals Court reversed most of the ruling that deemed Prop 22 illegal or invalid, rather. If that seems unintelligible to you, here it is. It's AB 5. We're talking about AB 5 and the fact that when it was launched in 2019, it was really aimed at Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash, gig economy, people who hired independent contractors. Lorena Gonzalez, now head of the Teamsters Union, again, the California Federation of Labor, and then just carrying water for her masters, introduced the bill in order to try to get all gig workers in the state and then the nation unionized. And Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash unite. If you're a frequent listener to the show, you know how much we hated what Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash did next, which was to say, hey, we're going to spend $200 million protecting ourselves. Everything else go, pound sand. So you still have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of workers in California who are independent contractors by every definition except the unions. But here's a court telling the unions who had appealed, Prop 22 wins, it secrets out Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. The unions go to war, the state sues, and now a judge says, nope, sorry, this Prop 22 that carves out an exemption for Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash, that's legit. They are carved out now. The unions have come back with the state and said, no, we're going to still sue. We're going to the state Supreme Court. We're going to ask them to settle this once and for all. But for the moment, David, AB 5, at least with regard to Silicon Valley gig companies, is stalled out.
Yes, it is. And there was no surprise that right now the more rational side of legal interpretation has prevailed. It will prevail in the end. The Ubers and Lyfts and other people victimized by AB 5 will end up winning on the merits, and the state should not be intervening in these matters. Drivers have every right to pick if they are in agreement with the status that the employer wants to give them. And AB 5 was an atrocity of a bill that did its most damage to the people it was allegedly trying to help.
Isn't that always the way it is?
It does seem to be very frequently.
Speaking of damaging the people you say you're trying to help, the LA Teachers Union has now announced that it will strike for 3 days at some point in the next... it will strike for some period of time. It looks like 3 days at some point in the next 2 weeks. I think I've got that straight. And they're going to do this in alliance with SEIU. Now, UTLA's contract is not up, so this is a sympathy strike, which is technically illegal under the terms the union has bargained for itself. But if you go on the union's super secret Facebook page, as some of our friends do who are teachers and very sympathetic to Radio Free California's perspective, you know that the teachers are now scrambling to figure out what their excuse is going to be. The number one excuse for not showing up at work in order to support the SEIU strike is we're sick. They're going to use the sick thing. I guess they learned it from third graders. So their tummy hurts. So this will be the third time that UTLA has shut down LA schools in just 4 years. In 2019, they shut them down for a full week, saying, of course, it was just for the kids. And they shut down the schools for 19 months in LA Unified School District. 19 months they shut the schools down, longest in the nation were our schools closed. And when the students came back and they began to perform badly on achievement tests, they declared the tests racist, and then said that, in fact, it didn't really test for the things that matter, like understanding politics and diversity and that sort of thing. So this will be the third strike, as I say. And it really hinges, let's turn the attention to Service Employees International Union, David, just for a sec here. This is a union that's in deep trouble. They are hemorrhaging members. By our calculations at California Policy Center, SEIU's membership since the Janus decision is down about 36%. They've lost
36% is from what number to what number?
That's a great question. I have to go get the absolute raw numbers for you. But it's we're talking about some 800,000 total SEIU members, about half of whom are government workers in the DMV and in schools like LA Unified. So it's a loss to them of multiples of tens of millions of dollars in annual revenue. That's a very good question. I'm sorry I don't have the answer at the fingertips here. But the bottom line is SEIU is arguing that its employees on average make less than $25,000 per year. That's what they're putting out there on social media and saying everywhere the media will amplify that message. Can you imagine trying to make it in California as a professional in our schools making less than $25,000 per year? And then you discover, as our own Ed Ring, the public finance expert, discovered, 75% of those who work for SEIU work just 3 to 6 hours per day. And SEIU's response to that is, hey, that's full time, according to our collective bargaining agreement. Yeah. So if you work 3 to 6 hours per day for in an SEIU capacity in the LA Unified School District, that's full time. That is a full-time job. The fact that you only work nine months...
This is SEIU, not CTA.
That's correct.
So are these people heroes?
They're all heroes, yes.
Because I thought it was only teachers.
No, everybody's a hero now.
If you're an SEIU worker and a teacher hears that you get called a hero, is the teacher mad?
Yes. In fact, that's what makes
this... not everyone's a hero.
That's right. Because what makes us interesting, David, and you've really hit on a point, leave it to you, that's really fundamental here. I think we've talked a little bit about this in the show, but everybody hates SEIU, including all other government unions and other unions. SEIU is a pirate ship floating the high seas. Yeah. They come in, they board your union ship wherever you are in the country. They stab you in the back, put everybody to the sword, and then take over representing, quote unquote, your workers. SEIU is not to be trusted by the other unions. They hate them. And so this moment of consanguinity among two major unions, especially the teachers and SEIU, is remarkable for that, because what I think UTLA is contemplating is the fact that they're going to need SEIU's help when they go back to the trough and beg for more cash. Now, the other thing that I wanted to point out, the union is saying, is that there's $5 billion in reserve. This is a classic union canard. They come into a union negotiation. They take a snapshot of your bank account, basically, at one moment. That is the moment that, say, federal and state funding hits. They take a snapshot of that. They tell the public, look, they're hiding billions from you. They're cheating us. In fact, the superintendent came out and said, we've got nothing like that, and we are going to run a deficit in the next 2 years of about $1 billion. There is no more cookie in the cookie jar here. So the union is struggling. Again, if you go to the back pages of these union websites where only members are allowed and those members are feeding us information, they are struggling to figure out how to counter the facts, the truth, that they're violating their collective bargaining agreement and going on strike, that their members actually don't work full-time jobs by anybody else's definition, and that finally there's no surplus available. And the superintendent there, Carvalho, has said, who's only been in the job like over a little over a year, is saying, like, look, you guys show me which programs you want to cut for kids and I'll give you your increase. He is absolutely daring them to tell the truth, which is, this is not for the kids. This is for the adults. And it's for adults who work 3 to 6 hours per day sometimes, 75% of them, 6 hours or less per day, considered full-time. I could move on, David, with much more than that, but that's probably enough on SEIU. What do you think?
Well, it's always enough because you know, there's so many things we talk about that have nuance, and there's certain like protagonists and antagonists in the political world, and SEIU is just from top to bottom so corrupt, so unpleasant to think about, the tactics, the whole thing. I have nothing good to say about them.
Yeah, there's not much more to be said, but I will say this. As I say, the union is in financial trouble. This strike is a way for the union's leaders to try to demonstrate their value to people who are contemplating leaving. And we're hitting them hard right now at CPC. I can tell you more offline, but the fact is we're in communication with lots and lots of SEIU members in LA Unified and across the state all the time, and we're helping them get out.
You know, 3 to 6 hours, that hit close to home for me.
Because?
That's how much I sleep.
They just have David Bonson world upside down.
Can you imagine working 3 to 6 hours and saying it's full time?
I can't. My dad.
In all seriousness, and I know people think I'm workaholic or whatever, but I don't care. 3 hours, not six, but 3 hours is the base minimum of what I want to work every day before anyone else in the world has woken up.
Yeah.
That's my goal. And if it doesn't happen, which it pretty much always does, but if it doesn't, it throws off my whole day. Like, just, and that is maybe because I'm so inefficient or something. That's fine. But like, I need 3 hours of work before anyone else is up just so I can get work done.
It's quiet then.
It's very quiet.
That's when 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock, best hours of the day.
Yeah.
Very quiet. All right, David, you have probably.
What do they do the rest of the time?
Well, in fairness, here's their deal. You know, a lot of these people are like monitors, playground monitors or classroom monitors or hallway monitors. They're the sorts of people who make sure the kids get into the school safely and then get to their classrooms. Then they go home and then they come back and they do another shift of an hour and a half or so, right?
Okay.
Bus drivers, people who prepare lunches.
Yeah, yeah.
Janitors who come in after hours for, you know, their 3 to 4 hours.
Want to be a bus driver.
No. You wouldn't? No, worse. I didn't want to be a bus rider.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Poor little David Bonson sitting on a bus.
Can you imagine what Kamala Harris went through?
It must have been terrible.
Yeah. You know, she was talking about it once with a guy. Who was that guy? Oh, it was Joe Biden. Do you remember that?
No, Biden doesn't either.
I forget. You know, that's one of the things that COVID really screwed up is we were in the midst of an awesome Democratic primary on that debate stage. You just had so much awesome stuff going on.
I am sorry. I finally got the reference. It's to segregation and busing.
When she went after Biden.
Yes. Oh, I'm so sorry.
So what were you laughing at? What did you think was funny about what
because
I was saying?
It's
you just thought I was being an abject racist or something?
No, I thought you were trying to imagine the unimaginable, which is Kamala Harris truly suffering the way she always claims she did as a young person.
Yeah, but you know, she went after Biden about
yes,
it.
Yes, that's right.
And that was in the same primary. Well, we've revisited a lot, but it was a great primary until COVID. And then the final debate, one of my favorite factoids of 2020, pre-COVID politics. This wasn't pre-COVID. By this point now, the CDC had announced it was airborne. Things were starting. It wasn't like the March level where Tom Hanks had it. That's when it got real, you know. But I'm saying it was like millions of cases in China and Italy and the whole thing. They did an entire debate and never once mentioned a single word about it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why do you suppose that was?
It just, they're saying, oh, Trump was downgrading, Trump was downplaying the danger of it. And I'm saying the week that you're saying he and like Kudlow took flak because he said, no, it looks like they have it under control. You know, like I have no doubt people believed it at the time. They were wrong, but it was what they kind of thought. But my point was, you guys thought it was such a huge event that was about to be this transformative global pandemic that would result in multi-year lockdowns of the world. You guys were so worried about that, unlike our cavalier president, that you did an entire debate where not one of you said a single thing about it the entire night.
Yeah. Well, there were more important things to talk about. Hey, David, you have seemingly talked yourself almost into a coma, I would imagine, because you've appeared almost everywhere talking about Silicon Valley Bank's collapse. And I think I have seen or read you just about everywhere but National Public Radio. Can you basically, you know, for those who are not really following all that closely, can you give us the news and then tell us your assessment of what this means, and particularly with regard to California? I have limited knowledge of the banking industry, and I'll share my amateur outsider's thoughts with you in a sec. But really, can you just tell us, what's the deal here? Summarize.
Well, in a nutshell, Silicon Valley Bank was a commercial and traditional bank that was built around some non-traditional commercial strategies, that is to bank for startup companies funded by venture capital out of Silicon Valley. And they, you know, were really subtle about it, that they named the bank Silicon Valley Bank. And they had a significant amount of deposits of entities that were kind of unprofitable tech startups that were crypto companies or crypto adjacent. There was a lot of IPOs and something called SPACs we won't get into now in 2020 and 21. They were receiving a lot of deposits from. And so they just had a kind of real hip, cool, tech-friendly business model of banking. And their deposits flew higher during 2020 and 21 as the Fed had rates at 0%. Tech was still booming. You had a work from home economy. Venture capital funds were raising whatever amount of money they wanted. It was sort of, if you put it back into the dot-com parlance from the generation in which I grew up as a young adult investor, they had unlimited access to capital to the pets.coms and globe.coms of the world. And this was the bank that was banking for those things. And so at the same time, they then had their own capital at a very low rate environment. You're not getting any money on your net interest margin because interest rates are 0%.
So, and this is where you make the money.
Yeah. So then you go and buy longer dated bonds and you're trying to capture a spread. And they apparently bought nearly $100 billion of long-dated bonds back when yields were between 1% and 2%. Interest rates flew up to 4%, so those bonds lost a lot of value on paper, but they were willing to hold them to maturity. So you're going to get $100 back for your $100 invested at the end. But the problem was that then all of a sudden, their depositors were withdrawing money, and they are at risk of a credit rating downgrade. So they go to raise capital and they got caught into a perfect storm where they couldn't raise capital because depositors were withdrawing money.
What alerted depositors?
That they were looking to raise capital.
Yeah.
Well,
how do they know?
That's one of the things that is going to be more known in the future. I don't have any doubt that they were just open about it. But was there a particular birdie? I mean, they had hired Goldman Sachs as their bank to help them raise capital. They had talked to General Atlantic, who's a large private equity firm. And you have to approach this with a military level, espionage level of secrecy, or just a cavalier arrogance that it won't matter if word gets out because we're going to close the deal and who cares. And they didn't close the deal and they didn't have secrecy. And then you did have Pete Thiel, amongst others, that were openly tweeting, and he runs a large venture capital firm of his own, saying to all of our portfolio companies that have their money with Silicon Valley Bank, I recommend you withdraw it.
Hmm. Oh, dear.
And so it created a run on the bank where depositors were drawing, which made investors unwilling to put in equity capital. And equity capital was not forthcoming, which was scaring depositors. And so this vicious cycle. And then by Friday morning of last week, they had about negative $960 million of capital. And so they were insolvent. And this is off of a $120 billion deposit base. That they were upside down $958 million.
So the ramifications seem, you know, national at least and probably global. We don't need to get into all of that, but Gavin Newsom claimed that he was working all weekend to help the regulators. And at least by two accounts I read, it was California regulators who stepped in first. Does that make any kind of sense to you?
No, it's not exactly accurate. There's a kind of nuance in there that will be a little bit complicated. There are local banking regulators. And then there's the Fed. The Fed actually had a regulator in the office there. Mm. And, you know, look, if you have short-term liabilities, which is your customer deposits, you say, why is that a liability? Because it's money you owe them.
Mm-hmm.
It's their money you owe them if they demand it. What does short-term mean? It's on demand. Nobody asks for all their money back at once, but in theory, your duration is 1 minute. And then you're buying bonds that mature in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That mismatch, usually you hedge, and there's derivatives and swaps and complicated financial products that help you hedge your interest rate risk. They had no hedges.
Oh, dear.
They didn't hedge rate risk. They had a very vulnerable deposit base, and they got caught in a perfect storm and were totally unprepared for it. And their risk management team was filled with people who were clearly unqualified. And there was a lot of woke stuff. They had very few finance people on their board. They had mostly politicals, kind of key people in the Democratic Party, old Hillary campaign people, that kind of stuff, Obama aides, what have you. But they didn't have any real grown-ups as far as financial expertise. Their risk team was, their Twitter profiles read like a parody of wokey woke, you know, religion.
Well, speaking of mismatches, there's the fact that Gavin Newsom has not said an awful lot about this. And he certainly
now, why do you think this should be a Gavin Newsom story?
Because I wonder if, in fact, let me ask you this. If this bank, Silicon Valley Bank, was really responsible for some share, whatever that is, of tech startups in Silicon Valley, that is in California, and California's tax system is set up to benefit from these kinds of massive startups and IPOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Gavin Newsom has a problem on his horizon, perhaps a financial problem.
Yes.
And if, in fact, he begins to amplify the message, oh, my God, the sky is falling and the banks are in terrible trouble, this could set off at least a regional banking problem, if not a national one, and one that would come back and bite him in the keister. He's already, you know, facing.
It's a far bigger problem for Gavin Newsom than the banking problem. The banking problem is a federal problem. The banks are under the oversight of the FDIC, which is a federal agency, and of the Treasury Department, which is a part of the executive branch of government, and of the Federal Reserve. Gavin's problem should be so lucky as to be banking oriented. His problem is the underlying industry that is itself banking there, which is the VC, the tech, the kind of customers of Silicon Valley that are right now distressed and troubled, to the extent that there is clearly the natural and expected cyclical reality. There's not all the money flowing into unprofitable startups that there was 3 years ago, and that they were making bank during that period of time, no pun intended. And then here's the thing. It's never one deal. This is at a time where, as we've talked about in past podcasts recently, already their tax base is eroding. The federal support from COVID is gone. And so California is stuck with a cost structure they can't shed and a revenue structure that's highly cyclical. And then one of the geese that lays the golden egg is now impaired.
Right.
The fact that some of the banks or one of the banks that these geese bank at has gone down is not Gavin Newsom's problem.
I'm trying to write down impaired geese. I think we've got our title for the episode.
Well, an impaired goose, but what's the plural of impaired goose?
Geese.
Impaired geese.
Yeah.
The impaired geese, the parrotids.
It's in the room, man. It's in the room, as we say in Hollywood.
The geeses.
Okay.
What's
so,
the plural? Why goose and plural is geese?
Geese, yeah.
And then moose and the plural is?
Meese.
But see, that's not, it's not right.
None of this makes sense. I agree.
It's so unfair. Have you ever heard the way I immediately, like I thought I had this question to like really see people's basic biblical literacy. Mm. And then Donald Trump came around and called it 2 Corinthians. And I was like, wow, I've set the bar way too high.
Yeah, really.
But I'd say who wrote 1 Peter? Mm-hmm. Peter, who wrote 1 John? Mm-hmm. John, you know, who wrote James? James. Who wrote 1 Timothy? Timothy. No, Paul did. And it's just sort of unfair, right?
Like it really is.
There's all these books written that are titled by the author and then one book titled by the recipient.
Yes.
Paul wrote it to Timothy. And I think that's the same kind of thing.
With geese and gooses.
Geese, moose, meese.
Meese. Yeah. Got it. Last question on the banks. Of course, the progressive crowd, led, I think, by its cheerleader, Elizabeth Warren, has come out and said, see, I told you. In fact, she used those words this morning in an interview with her favorite outlet, NPR, and said that, you know, of course, her whole claim that Wall Street and the banks are in collusion against America, this is now borne out. See, I told you these people are living high on the hog. You point out that high on the hog includes diversity, inclusion and equity stuff and, you know, Democratic policy people or at least political figures on the board. But David, what's wrong with her argument that what we just really needed here was better regulation of the sort that Elizabeth Warren would have brought?
It's an offensively stupid argument because I actually, though, it's not that I disagree. It's that I'm literally shocked that people are using it. What regulation do you need that you didn't already have? They got to see the balance sheet. They saw the duration was the same for both their hedged and unhedged bond portfolio. They knew the bank had $50 billion of deposits one day and $180 billion a year later. They knew their depositors were VC startup companies and that one depositor was a crypto company that had $3.3 billion of uninsured money in their account. Mm. They knew that 97.9% of their deposits were uninsured, meaning above the FDIC limit. They knew all these things. Dodd-Frank said that this would never happen again. So we passed the biggest banking regulation bill in world history on top of the most regulated sector in world history. And they go, finally, we put an end to this. It'll never happen again. Then it happens again. And these a-holes say that, we need more regulation.
Now,
here's your regulation to keep it from happening. Let's end all banks and all money and all finance and all activity.
And trade eggs.
And no, not that, because there could be fraud with that. There could be people that don't get the eggs right. They can't count the eggs.
No more transactions?
You could have regulatory bodies oversee the eggs, but what's going to happen? They look at something, they think it's an egg, it turns out it's a baseball.
It's a rock, yeah.
All this kind of stuff. This is obviously, I can't stand it when people say, we don't need more competence, we need more laws.
Mm-hmm.
You were incompetently regulating with laws that existed and you want us to give you new laws. That is how you get statism. There is a perfectly evil actor here at the company itself for incompetence and hubris and whatnot. And then regulators that were clearly totally asleep. And I'm sorry, but there's no statute that or no regulatory stipulation that had it been in place would have kept this from happening if you have morons driving the boat. And you know who said this about the regulatory atmosphere is not what created this? That there was not inadequate regulation that caused it?
Barney Frank, author of, yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, I said last question, but I swear I have one last one. And this is from a listener who asked us to talk about moral hazard and the fact that Joe Biden has come out and said, no taxpayers were injured by this. It's not being covered by taxes. There's no problem here because the Fed has stepped in and the federal government's going to make sure that all this money is, you know, is insured no matter what. Talk to me about whether, A, that statement is true. No, you know, tax dollars were hurt. I think that's a definitional point that you could probably clear up for us. But also, what's what's the limiting principle here? What's the moral hazard in stepping in this time and saying like, okay, we know it's a $100,000 limit, but we're going to go up to 250.
It's 250.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, but we're going higher, right, on this one?
Well, they are unlimited coverage for uninsured depositors for these two banks.
Got it. Okay. So talk to us about moral hazard and whether tax
I'm happy to talk about it, but I just want to point out it's the wrong question yet again. When people say, do you support this? I love Bernanke's analogy from GFC. Is you have 30 years of policy incompetence, then the world gets set on fire and people go, do you approve of them putting out the fire? I'm sorry that I'm not perfectly aligning myself with the conservative talking points here. I'm totally against what they've done. But no, Biden didn't have a choice. And Trump would have done the same thing because their risk, it had nothing to do with Silicon Valley Bank. It had nothing to do with their customers. It had to do with the fact that there was a run on the bank of other regional banks that then were saying, well, what do we not know is going on? You know what? I feel safer at JP Morgan Chase or Wells Fargo or Bank of America or what have you. And we would have ended up with a grand total of four banks in the whole country. And so to deal with contagion risk, which is a fire you can't put out once it starts, financial panics are just inherently awful. So in order to avoid a contagion, they said, okay, well, let's just say we're going to cover these uninsured depositors. And then you get people saying things like, well, the total amount of bank deposits is equal to GDP of the country. So they're going to just have to come somehow cover $30 trillion as if like there's no assets. Okay, Silicon Valley Bank, if they didn't do it, their depositors were going to get back 98 cents on the dollar.
Hmm.
They were underwater about 2%. You can't have a negative net worth as a bank. So that's too much. But by the time FDIC froze things Friday, the recovery was as low as 95%. My estimates are 98%. And I spent hours analyzing the balance sheet on Saturday and Sunday. So, okay, that it doesn't matter though. You cannot have a delay. When people put money in a bank, they think they're getting it back right away. And yet the law is the law, and we had a coverage limit of $250,000. So my concern is that they leave it willy-nilly. They did not say we're covering all deposits going forward. They said for these two banks.
Mm-hmm.
But who in their right mind doesn't think they would cover First Republic if it went under tomorrow? And so you have this implicit guarantee, which is what they had with Fannie and Freddie for years. You make it explicit. If you want unlimited depositor insurance, and then figure out how you're going to pay for it. And that's going to be expensive. Or don't have the coverage. But see, leaving it willy-nilly is my problem. Is there moral hazard here? Yes, but who is the moral hazard with? People saying, oh yeah, they're bailing out this institution. That's bad vocabulary. It's bad use of the English language. They're not bailing out this institution. The equity is worth zero. A week ago, there were very rich owners of this bank, and they're now broke. That's not a bailout. The bondholders who put in 100 cents and we're going to get back 100 cents in the dollar are going to get back zero, the unsecured bondholders. They were wiped out. The people who got bailed out were the depositors who were not from the bank. Now, people are pointing out, kind of rightly in this case, that the depositors are not Grandpa and Grandma Smith, who the FDIC was meant to protect. And it was not farmers, and it was not a community bank for churches. And I'm perfectly fine to admit that if it were, they probably wouldn't have done it. But my point is that the contagion risk wasn't going to discriminate. The contagion risk was not going to say, hey, they didn't bail out this group, but our bank is perfectly safe. No depositor does credit analysis.
Right.
So they were trying to put out the contagion risk. I don't believe it's the right precedent, but in Dave Land, I don't have to answer the question because it never would have happened in Dave Land because you wouldn't have had a Federal Reserve firing up this bubble to begin with and then coming in and over tightening on the other side and bursting it. So the Fed screwed this thing up twice.
That's what I want to underscore because I read this in your Dividend Cafe that the real challenge here was just monetary policy and a bubble in cash that was floating out there at 0%. And then suddenly you start ratcheting up interest rates and these people got caught. The other big story this past week was something that may have eluded a lot of listeners. It certainly didn't get the attention that Silicon Valley Bank did. And that is a lawsuit between the state and the city of Huntington Beach and between city of Huntington Beach and the state over what might seem like a really mundane sort of thing. And that's the process by which cities in California, 480 182 of them, are required by law to present a housing plan. Now, this last cycle of housing plans over the last several years since Newsom got into office have been troubled by this fact that Newsom has declared a housing crisis in California. I think the people who say this the best and they are the worst are the LA Times. Here's the LA Times assessment of this lawsuit, and it tells, this is just kind of for background. They say, California has a crippling housing shortage that has driven up home prices and rents, fueled homelessness, and pushed residents and businesses out of state. So, David, this is their explanation for the California exodus, which the LA Times has denied has ever occurred. Now suddenly they're on it. And the cause is, continue, and yet the city's leaders somehow think their wealthy Orange County coastal enclave should be exempt from producing their fair share of homes. So this is class warfare. It misdiagnoses the problem of, you know, both homelessness and high cost of housing in California, but it is exactly Gavin Newsom's argument. Yeah, it's expensive to build a house or to buy a house in California, and you know what the reason is? It's cities that won't build more housing. Now, where is it in the Constitution that says cities must build housing over and against the interests of their residents, over and against the interests of developers who may be developing property, whatever? The city is big, the state is bigfooting in under Newsom and telling cities that they must build a specific number of homes, could be apartments, in their city. But these are mostly dense cities. So when I hear the LA Times talk about a, you know, a wealthy coastal enclave, why would you want to build more housing there? Most Californians live on 5% of the land. 5% of the land of California is where 95% of our California residents live. And the state has decided under Gavin Newsom there's a housing crisis that must be solved by packing millions of more houses into the existing places where housing is, rather than, say, looking at the rest of the state. So I'm getting ahead of myself. When Huntington Beach said, you know what, Gavin Newsom, we're not going to build 13,500 new homes in Huntington Beach. We have a whole bunch of reasons. You don't live here. We do. We know where those homes would go. Environmentally sensitive areas or areas that are already built up. It would destroy the character and quality of our community that for which people have paid to live. And we're just not going to do it. Newsom says he's outraged. He's going to show them what for. And he makes statements like this, saying, I'm serious about solving the housing crisis. If you don't believe me, go ask the folks in Huntington Beach. So he orders last Thursday Attorney General Rob Bonta to file suit against Huntington Beach, saying that they refuse to build their fair share of housing, 13,500 homes in the city of Huntington Beach. Huntington Beach says, oh, yeah? And they file a suit, but not in state court, in federal court, sure. David. And their suit, which makes awesome reading, and I should put this on the show notes. You can go read it yourself, or you can read my summary of it. The bottom line is they're making a variety of claims, the most important of which are, hey, look, under Gavin Newsom's housing regime, we are told that we must conclude in a statement of overriding conditions that no other law matters in the city of Huntington Beach. Not environmental quality laws that we've been forced to adhere to, not the Coastal Commission we've been forced to yield to. None of this other stuff matters. None of it matters. We are required to file a document that says, yeah, we looked at all this other stuff about traffic mitigation and wetlands and the Coastal Commission and the ocean, et cetera, and we just believe that we have to build 13,500 homes. Huntington Beach said, we won't play that game. And to make us do it, to make us arrive at a specific decision that the governor thinks is absolutely incumbent on us to make, violates our free speech. This is called state speech or state sanctioned speech. And the governor has insisted that every one of those 482 cities in California absolutely file a statement of overriding conditions, rather, which says we've looked at all the other factors that we might be forced to consider, and we've decided they don't matter.
That LA Times editorial is one of the most arrogant things I have ever read in my life. And I want to point something out. I am opposed to NIMBYism. And I do not believe that we should say that we are going to make our decisions based on trying to protect those who already, we're going to deny property rights to people based on the preferences of rich and powerful entrenched people. And I do believe that Newport Beach could have more housing if its own citizens did not work so much against high density projects, for example, which several high profile and really quite effective and well-planned high density projects were voted down in an anti-growth movement by the very people that made their money in a pro-growth world that they grew up in Newport. So I have mixed feelings on the whole subject until you get to the point of what's really going on here, which is that the state is suing cities and regulating cities for things that the state caused.
Yes.
You could have the housing supply you want. Now, first of all, the line in the LA Times op-ed that I have to push back on, I can't tolerate this line that a lack of housing has fueled homelessness.
That's right.
That is a damn lie.
Yes.
A lack of housing has created an artificial boost. A lack of supply, inadequate supply relative to demand, has boosted prices and challenged affordability. But it has not created homelessness. Drug abuse, mental health issues, other behavioral and psychological and social epidemics create homelessness, not a lack of a new project from William Lyon Homes. Okay, I hate to break it to these people how this stuff works.
But this is the whole housing.
But why are there not more? Why is there not more housing stock?
Because of state regulation, primarily.
Environmental.
Yes.
Coastal.
Yes.
The regulatory apparatus is so nasty. And then for them to come and say, we're demanding you go build more housing, it is a constitutional affront. And it also is in total ignorance about the way markets work. Do you know what generates supply? The fact that someone believes they will profit from building the supply. Is there more demand for housing in cities like Huntington and Newport Beach? Of course there is. So why do you think builders are disincentivized? Could it be the wait they have to go through to get zoning? Could it be the unbelievable environmental restrictions, the lawsuits, the various ADA issues? The thing is a mess, and everybody knows it. Now, I happen to believe that a big part of the problem on inadequate high density is voters. Mm-hmm. That voters simply say, I love living here now, and I don't want anybody new here. And that's NIMBYism, and I'm against it. I think it's a grotesque violation of property rights. But I think private parties can work that out. I don't think that the government is needed to put a mandate on what a city has to build in housing. And so I hope Huntington Beach's lawsuit goes the right way, and it sounds to me like they're constructing a good case.
I think so, too. Much more could be said on this, but I think we've kind of covered that. And again, I'll put some stuff in the show notes for people. David, let's take a quick moment here. We only have a few minutes left, but I do want to get to a few just updates and letters, if I may. Last week, you and I said that we had discovered a unicorn, California Democrats who actually like guns, so long as that gun is in the hands of a criminal from a minority community. We also predicted that bill would die in the legislature, and then it did.
Yeah, we nailed that one.
Yeah, AB 328, that's by one of my new favorite politicians, a guy named Bill
Scott Wiener.
No, it's not Scott Wiener, but we'll come to Scott in just a moment.
He's been your favorite as long as I've been doing this podcast with you.
A guilty pleasure. Assemblyman Bill Esaley, he's a Republican from Riverside in the Assembly. His bill was AB 328, and it would have prohibited judges from dismissing firearms-related sentencing enhancements. In other words, he was saying, no, we need to, if a criminal is found guilty of a crime and used a gun in the commission of that crime, there should be an enhancement. That is, we should add time to that person's prison sentence. And the Assembly Democrats said, oh my God, not a chance, because this might affect marginalized communities. So Bill Esaley's bill, down, gone. Let's see. Then we've got a letter from listener Smith, but it's spelled P. Smith. The P is silent, as a PG Woodhouse fan would know. He or she writes, love your show, but one small nit to pick. The Quinnipiac poll is not located in Wisconsin, not even close. It is run by Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. That's on me.
You know what we were thinking of is Marquette?
Marquette is the one that, yeah. Yeah, thank you. That is in Wisconsin. I also...
Oh, by the way, when I said Wisconsin agreeing with you last week, I think I was on like 46 painkillers from an eye surgery.
you need to share. I mentioned another error. I mentioned A Clockwork Orange, the fabulous novel and film that ought to be required reading for California's progressive officials who believe the justice system's first priority is, understanding and empathizing with criminals. Readers or viewers of A Clockwork Orange know what I'm talking about. Good old Harry Angel wrote in and said, no, it was Anthony Burgess who wrote A Clockwork Orange. But don't beat yourself up, he writes. Hell, I once told a crowd that we should all remember the risks Louis Armstrong took when he landed on the moon. Sadly, I don't think anyone caught it. Joe Biden, this is from John Amirati, a listener. Thank you, John. You and I were talking about the fact that Joe Biden, the Democratic Party, and good old Rob Bonta are really hot right now about hidden fees and consumer transactions. They've looked at like hotel resort fees, you know. And they do not want to look at the hidden fees imposed by government all along the government food chain. You and I discussed this a couple of weeks back, I think. And I described in that conversation getting a speeding ticket in Shasta County for $85. But by the time I actually paid the bill with added on fees and fines, the total cost was somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 to $600. I forget at this point. But John says, I can sympathize with your experience in Shasta County. I was one of the first Californians to get a seatbelt ticket in 2006 as a passenger. When the law passed the assembly, we were assured it would be a minor fee, just $20. But by the time the hidden fees and processing charges were added, it came close to 10 times that amount. Speaking of hidden fees, a UCLA student listener, I hope that UCLA listener appreciated your primer on the March Madness, said, check out the list of fees on top of UCLA tuition. He sent us a list of hidden fees that bury students in debt. I won't go over all of them, David, except to say that it
is one of the fees for penicillin shots.
Booyah. You've got the graduation fee. It costs $40 to graduate from UCLA. You have to pay $40 in a fee. Undergrad health insurance, whether you want it or not, almost $1,000.
You know what they do for the $40 to graduate at UCLA? All the kids have to come up with the 3 10s and the 20. I can do this all day.
I am recovering from a cold, and I am so filled with disgusting fluids. Thank God I wasn't drinking. I'll just run through a couple of these. Green Initiative, $4.80. Pledge fee, $19.59.
Every time they say the Pledge of Allegiance. you gotta pull out a 20.
Punishment. There's a seismic fee for a building, a parking fee, a Bruin, whether you park there or not, by the way. Bruin Bash. I don't know what that is. Some kind of party where they celebrate the loss to USC, I suppose. IEI spring fee. The student could not tell me what this $108 was for. Spring Arts. Committee fee, spring something basic needs fee. That's the one where they are paying a student-run nonprofit to collect clothes and give them away. A project so desirable that they charge everybody to do it because it should be free. So, anywho, David, I could go on, but there's the fees. Regarding Mike Lindell, listener Doug responded. Now, remember that we talked about Mike Lindell, speaking of Shasta County, was there to help Shasta County officials. This is the MyPillow guy. He was there to help Shasta officials dump Dominion voting machines in favor of any other means of vote counting. Listener Doug responds, Dominion voting systems should immediately send Lindell and Shasta County officials a fruit basket and a nice thank you note. The company's $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News depends in part on its ability to prove it was damaged by Fox's malignant reporting on the 2020 election. In voting to kill its contract with Dominion voting systems, Shasta and his friend Lindell just help make the company's case. There we go. So, David, just a couple of things here to wrap up our business for the day. I want to talk about some bills. One of my least favorite here is a bill being I love the bill. It is, but here's the headline by Andrew Sheeler of Sacramento Bee. The headline reads, California bill would compel teachers to out transgender students to their parents, to out their kids to themselves. So here's the deal. AB 1314 gives school employees 3 days to notify parents in writing if they learn that a student is publicly identifying as transgender, that is transgender, such as by participating in gender-segregated sports programs or using bathroom facilities for a gender other than the one appearing on their birth certificate. Asaley told the Bee in an interview, parents are not spectators of their kids. They are parents. They are responsible for the kids' well-being. This bill is running into a meat grinder of opposition from the state legislators, all lawmakers. This is attacking the vulnerable. Clearly, the headline is meant to intend something that's just not happening. Scott Wiener tweeted out against the bill. Nope, not in California. So Asaley, again, I absolutely adore this guy. Remember, he's the guy with the gun enhancements law that got buried in committee. The lawmaker called his bill a reset for the relationship between schools and parents. Though his bill touches on a sensitive topic, Asaley said he doesn't view it as controversial. He wrote on Twitter, "Children are the domain of their parents, not the government. My bigger concern is the mental health and well-being of the minor." He said, you know, lots of people are saying, oh, my God, what about these kids will go home and their parents will know that they're identifying at school as a different gender? And Asaley said he was sympathetic. He gets it. That, you know, this could be a challenge for some kids. But the fact is that fundamentally, the kids belong to the parents, not to the state. And if the teachers have evidence of abuse against the kids by the parents, there's already a mechanism in place. They are first reporters, right? So if something, teachers are. So if something bad happens to a kid at home as a result of a parental interaction and the teachers are utterly convinced, right now the law already exists. Teachers are mandated reporters. They must identify the child and the problem with social services and let an investigation unfold. That system already exists, Asaley points out. So David, I just wanted to say, I think this is a bill that actually does sort of, as Asaley says himself, this resets the relationship between parents and schools, at least on this critical issue.
Oh, I agree completely. I think that if we had more time, we could unpack what's really going on here just in the broader culture war. But I think the way you're highlighting this specific manifestation, California, spot on.
Okay, I'll make these last two really quick. We just talked about housing and how state policy is ridiculous. Here's a headline, and it tells you almost everything you need to know. A new constitutional amendment would guarantee Californians' right to housing. What could go wrong with a constitutional amendment that guarantees no matter who you are, where you are, what you're doing, what you've done, how you live your life, whether you can afford it, you have a right to housing? And then finally, David, I just want to say, Wiener Watch. Here's the editorial, and you got to love this. This is from the Mercury News, which is not always on our side, but on this issue they are, thank God. Their editorial is, "California lawmakers try again to deceive the voters. At issue is transparency for billions of dollars of bonds pushed by school, city, county, and transit districts." They are talking about a bill which our buddy Scott Wiener has decided he's going to run again. And let me see if I could read this. "At issue is transparency for billions of dollars of bond measures put before voters by school, city, and county and transit district leaders. Many voters don't understand that bonds are a form of borrowing. And what this bill from Wiener and the labor unions who back him." Now, this is government unions and others do not want this message out there. And here it is. Here's the story from the Mercury News. Wiener and the labor unions and local officials who backed his effort know that most voters with a long list of measures and candidate races in their ballots are unlikely to go beyond ballot wording. And this bill would make it absolutely unintelligible. Would make the matter of bond debt and taxation absolutely invisible to most voters in California. I could go on with this all day, David, but why don't we just maybe wrap it up here, because that's all the time we have today.
All right.
You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. I say this every week, and I'm hoping you're listening. If you subscribe to the show and you rate and review us, that helps other people find us. And don't you want to share the joy with others? Of course you do. Please email us your comments and story suggestions, as so many of you did this week. Thank you very much. That's where I got most of my run list. interest. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. So on behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and our researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian, and to all of our friends at National Review, especially you, Sarah Schutte, National Review podcast producer, we thank you. And Metalachi, of course, the LA-based mariachi and metal band. We thank you for our music, which you're going to hear in just a second after I say it with me, La Revolución Continúa en la Semana Próxima.